Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome to day 10 of our continuing coverage across our network of podcasts from True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. It is the 7th of February, 2023, as we take you into the courtroom for our first segment of coverage.
Good morning. Any further comment or argument regarding the witness from yesterday, the last Ms. Smith.
Ms. Smith's
testimony, yes.
Yes, Your Honor. We did get a transcript, overnight transcript of her testimony. It's very rough, but on recross, if you will, at page 90, I asked her, have you ever seen this rain jacket before? And the rain jacket, I put a photograph into evidence, Defense Exhibit 87. And she says, no. And then I said, did Alec Murdaugh have that rain jacket with him when he came to Ms. Libby's home on the morning, I believe a few days after the funeral? She says, no. And then I ask her, have you ever been in this closet before? Pointing to the state's exhibit, where they show something folded up. She says, no, I haven't. And then I ask her, so you don't know what that is folded up there, do you? And she says, correct. And then I ask her, if what's in that closet is this rain jacket, you've never seen Alec Murdaugh with it, with this garment before, have you? And she says, no, I haven't. And that's the testimony that, and that's on page 90 of the rough transcript that we got last night. Well, this morning we got it, Your Honor.
All right. From the state.
Your Honor, again, it is fairly rough to try to read some of this, but I would go back and point to page 65, where the witness was asked to describe, again, she talked about observing Alec coming to the house at an unusual time, a few days after the murders, carrying a bundled up blue vinyl item, and then she was shown a picture with it in that closet where it was recovered, and she said, did you see a blue object in the center? Yes. Does it appear to look like the object you've described? Yes. You're saying yes. Is it the blue vinyl? This appears to be the same thing you saw the defendant holding. It looks so. Yes. And of course, then you had subsequent testimony from the crime scene investigator about recovering that very item that proved to be the raincoat, which of course, if you hold it out, is very, very large and very much like a tarp. So I think many of these issues that the defense is raising are issues for jury argument and go to weight, not admissibility.
The witness testified on direct examination that the item in evidence appeared to be what Mr. Murdaugh brought into the house that night. She said he was carrying something. It was in his arm. She said it was blue something, that it looked something like a tarp, a blue something. But she did not know what it was. It wasn't opened up, and she could not clearly identify the item either as a tarp, as was shown by Mr. Griffin, or as a raincoat. She testified that the item presented was consistent in appearance with what Mr. Murdaugh brought into the home that night, and what was shown in the photograph that was taken. Certainly Mr. Griffin did an effective job in cross-examination in raising questions as to the credibility of the witness. That is the exact job that a jury has to do, that is weigh the credibility of the witness and to determine whether the testimony was consistent on the one hand or inconsistent on the other hand. And this witness's testimony was consistent on the one hand and inconsistent on the other hand, but that does not make the testimony inadmissible. It doesn't render the evidence inadmissible. Whether evidence can be made relevant and admissible through inference. The inferences can be drawn from the evidence. It is circumstantial evidence that is a part of this case, which suggests a fact by implication or inference. It could be the appearance of the scene of a crime, testimony that suggests a link to the crime, and if it can, facts can be proven through inference. The facts and circumstances through which the witness testified on direct and cross-examination and taking the testimony as a whole, the item is in evidence. I find that it is relevant in that it creates, through inference, facts that are in dispute in this case. And I deny the motion to strike her testimony, if that's what the motion is. I deny the motion to declare her testimony as being irrelevant. And the latest motion was that it's prejudicial, or the results of an examination of the item is prejudicial. Of course, we haven't had that testimony, but we have an item in evidence. We have many items in evidence. We have, items are being placed in evidence as, what number are we up to now? 400, 500? 400 items of evidence. Witnesses have been questioned as to whether they walked the side of the roadway to see whether anything was along the roadway other than a cell phone. Witnesses have been questioned as to whether or not they looked down the drain pipe or of a tub or shower or just any number of questions been posed with the witness to the witnesses as it relates to discovery of evidence. This evidence was obtained through a search warrant. It is in evidence and it's there for the jury's consideration. Certainly once an item is in evidence, and as long as a chain of custody has been established, there can be testimony as to what it is or of what significance is it. And that's the stage we are here in these proceedings. And I deny the motion to strike it, to find it for relevance purposes or because it creates or presents evidence favorable to the state, which automatically means it would be prejudicial to the defendant. Yes, sir.
Your Honor, just to clarify, the motion that the defense made late yesterday afternoon was in advance of Megan Fletcher, SLED agent Megan Fletcher's testimony that there's GSR on the blue rain jacket. And so the motion was to prevent her from testifying as to the GSR, the testing of the rain jacket, under 403. I understand the court's ruling. I don't think they're going to call Ms. Fletcher first, but when she does take the stand, we will, for the record, renew the objection. And
no, that's just the point. You say you object under 403, claiming it's more prejudicial than probative. And that's a fact-finding issue. That's an issue to be weighed not by me, but by the fact finder. I aim to determine whether it's more prejudicial than probative. It's relevant. It's apparently important enough that the state seeks to use it. All evidence adverse to the defendant can be considered to be prejudicial, but I do not find where any prejudice is substantially outweighs its probative value. So I deny that motion. I certainly respect your objection. The witness was sort of all over the place with her testimony and appeared to be confused. I'm not sure she obviously was not of the same level of unable to articulate her thoughts through her emotions and through this setting of being examined and cross-examined in this case. But the testimony taken as a whole shows that she identified the item as being consistent with what she thought the defendant brought in. She said he had something in it. It's important enough for her to contact someone about it and that landed her here on the witness stand, among other things, other reasons. But everything is noted and protected for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, sir. Ready for the jury.
Proceed, Your Honor.
Right. Regarding juror number 729, I spoke with him briefly. Spoke with that juror briefly this morning, and he's going to stay with us. He's made some arrangements, he thinks, with his job, and he's going to stay with us. We have another juror, however, juror number 548, who made contact with the court and says that he's at the emergency room this morning. We don't know what his situation is. He is an alternate juror, and we'll need to proceed without him. Juror number 548. You know, as time passes, attrition kicks in. We've done well thus far. This will be the first juror who will be excused. He's at the emergency room. We don't know how long he'll be there. We're not going to delay the trial until we find out. So we'll proceed without that juror. Yes, sir.
Stay here.
All right. You bring the jury.
The jury is present, sir.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Day number 11. You sure? 12. I said 12, yeah. Day number 12, state's case. No, 5 days in a week. You may proceed, state's case.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The state would call Jeannie Seckinger.
Your Honor, for the record, we renew our objection to this witness's question.
And yes, sir.
Thank you.
Come on. Left hand on the bed. Do you affirm the testimony about to give the court in this trial, so give the truth, so help me God?
I did.
State your name again for the record. When you take the seat, spell your last name, please.
My name is Jeannie Seckinger, S-E-C-K-I-N-G-E-R.
Ms. Seckinger, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
Awesome. Tell the jury a little bit about yourself, if you could. Just kind of introduce yourself. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school?
I grew up in Hampton, South Carolina. Graduated from Wade Hampton. Went to the University of South Carolina, where I got my B.S. in accounting. After that, I worked a number of years in public accounting. Then I transferred into as a financial analyst with Westinghouse in Hampton. And after the birth of my second child, I stayed home and worked for my husband just a few years. And in 1999, I came to work with the firm on a part-time basis, doing some special projects, and have not left. And that job has grown since that time till I was over all the business aspects and financial aspects of the law firm.
All right, which law firm are you talking about?
Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Elsdrop, Dietrich.
Is that PMPED?
That's correct.
Is that what the firm is currently known, or is it known by a different name?
We are now a separate entity that we've reorganized as Parker Law Group, LLP.
And do you know the defendant, Alec Murdoch, over there?
I do.
Do you see him in the courtroom?
I do.
Can you identify him, please?
He's in the blue jacket and white shirt sitting between Jim and Dick.
Your Honor, can the record reflect she's identified the defendant?
Yes.
Was he a partner in the law firm you're speaking of?
He was.
Is he a partner anymore?
No.
And we're going to talk about some of those things, the reasons for that here today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, so I'm going to call it PMPED. What we're talking about. Is that fair?
That's fair.
All right. Well, tell me, you talked a little bit about your role in PMPED. What would you consider your role, or how would you define your role, particularly as we're moving into June of 2021?
At that point, I would be CFO / COO, basically over all office management and all financial affairs of the office, over hiring and firing, HR, just any, like I said, any business aspect of the firm.
CFO, that means what?
Chief Financial Officer.
And COO, that means what?
Chief Operating Officer. And so I kind of combine those jobs.
All right. Are you a lawyer?
I am not.
Are you an accountant?
I am.
Do you have a CPA?
I do.
You said you started working for the firm when?
August of 99.
And then when did, was Alec working there at that time, the defendant?
I think Alec came to work the year after me.
Okay. Did you know him prior to that?
I did. I've known Alex since I was 16 years old in high school.
Y'all went to high school together?
We did. He's a few years behind me, but we were in the same school.
And you worked with Alec at the law firm up until September of 2021?
I did.
Let's talk a little bit, if we could, about the law firm itself. And tell me a little bit about the financial structure of the law firm. How does it work that fees come into the law firm, and how do they get dispersed at the end of the year? Can you explain that to the jury a little bit?
Yes. So every fee that any attorney makes is property of the law firm. It comes into the law firm and goes into the law firm's accounts, and it is sitting in kind of what we call a holding account that we just amass the money. We have another account called the operating account that we use to pay the daily bills of the law firm, wages, insurance, office supplies, et cetera. Each attorney in the law firm is also an employee of the law firm. They receive a paycheck just like most people do, with W-2 taxes taken out and W-2 at the end of the year. When we get to the end of the year, we figure the net profit of the law firm, basically everything brought in and everything paid out to date. And we distribute that money based off a ratio of what that fee, what that attorney brought in to total. So if an attorney brought in 10%, he's going to get roughly 10% of the net income at the end of the year. And we do that in a form of a bonus one time at the end of the year.
When is that bonus typically paid?
That bonus is typically paid the last week of December every year.
And is that the, for most cases and most of the partners, as we're going to call them, in the law firm, is that the vast majority of their compensation of the year, is getting it all in one lump sum at the end of the year in December?
That's correct. They receive a salary of $125 through the year that they're paid every 2 weeks, but the vast majority of their money comes in that one bonus check.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there was a salary. Looking back at June of 2021, what were the partners in the law firm, what were they getting as a salary?
$125,000 a year.
All right, $125,000, and that was broken up into checks like
26 times a year, yes.
Okay. So that has to be accounted for before the bonuses are paid, correct?
That's correct.
Salaries not only for the partners, but also for all the other employees.
That's correct, all staff.
All right, and is there other overhead that has to be accounted for out of the fees before that bonus can be paid?
Yes, all the other overhead is the basic operating expenditures, like I discussed, rent for the building, insurance coverage for the employees, office supplies, case costs that we advance for our clients. We pay things as we go for the during the case. We pay experts, record fees. All of that is part of overhead. So after everything that's paid, everything brought in, after everything that's paid out is what we call that net income that we distribute.
Is there some sort of 7.5% fund or offset that has to be accounted for as well before the bonus is paid?
There is. We have what we call 7.5% kind of profit sharing. And everybody takes a their gross fees less their portion of overhead. We take overhead and divide it by the number of partners. And so you would take, let's just going to use numbers. If your gross fees were $100,000 and your overhead was $50,000, you have a net of $50,000. And we take 7.5% of that and put it in a pot and divide it back evenly in between everybody. And that purpose is meant to cover when somebody has a high year or a low year. It kind of helps people out and it helps account for differences and expenses between each attorney.
So all of that has to be taken care of before the bonus is paid out to the partners at the end of the year, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then whatever money is left over is divided up based on the percentage of the fees that that particular partner brought in of the whole for the year, is that
correct? That's correct.
So if you had a better year, you're going to get a little bit more than somebody who didn't have as good a year?
Absolutely.
Okay. Over time, being the CFO, did Alec Murdoch have a very lucrative practice?
He did.
Were there times where his bonus was high six figures?
Definitely.
Were there times his bonus was seven figures?
There has been.
And was it typical for the vast majority of his compensation to be in that one-time bonus at the end of the year as opposed to the $125,000 salary?
Yes, his and everybody else's.
That $125,000 salary for these individuals was a fairly small part of the compensation.
Correct.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned is that at the very beginning, as you said, all fees belong to the firm. Is that right?
That is right.
And I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 310 to your testimony real quick and see if you can recognize this particular document.
I do. This is the employment agreement that each of the attorneys in the firm sign.
All right. I'll take that back real quick. Can I have the envelope, please? I would offer 310 at this time, Adams.
No additional objection, Joe.
It's admitted.
Let me let this element boot up real quick. I guess let's try it again. So is this Exhibit 310, is this the first page of that agreement?
Yes.
All right, and on your little screen up there, can you read that all right?
Yes.
Okay. If we look at talking about employer and employees, now we've been talking about the law firm partners, but in the agreement, what are they referred to as?
They're actually shareholders, so we refer to them as partners in the fact that they all work together and support each other, but because of the tax entity, we are their shareholders. It's just a legal and accounting determination. But in fact, you'll see them referred to as shareholders.
All right, but in this agreement, they're called employees, correct?
That's correct.
Now, just real quick, you talked about paying out the bonus at the end of the year, and that's where the vast majority of compensation for the partners goes out. Is there a tax reason for that? Do y'all clear the books at the end of the year?
We do clear the books at the end of the year. We function as a C corporation, which means any money that's left in that C corporation would pay a tax too. So to avoid double taxation, we pass that money down to the partners to the best of our ability.
All right. And so do you try to zero out the books?
We do.
All right. And that's just to avoid taxing on anything that remained in the firm accounts?
Correct.
So let me ask you this. The firm essentially zeroes out the books by paying these bonuses to all the partners at the end of the year. How do you operate in January and February where we're at now before fees start to come in? What money do you use to do that?
So typically a group of partners will go in and loan money back to the firm to cover our first couple months of operating expenses. And as we recover money through the year, we'll pay them back and pay them off. So we're basically starting at almost a negative by borrowing that money.
All right, and so some of the partners will loan money to the firm to operate until there's enough fees that come in to generate enough money. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do the partners have to do that, or is that something they can do if they want?
That's something that they can do if they want.
Was Alec one to ever do that?
Alec never did that.
He never did that. Okay. Before we go on back to this agreement, let me ask you a little bit. As far as the firm accounts, you mentioned there's an operating account, correct?
That's correct.
And then there's a client trust account, correct?
That's correct.
Trust account.
Trust account.
Tell me what the client trust account is, please.
So the trust account is a fiduciary account, meaning that we have the responsibility to maintain and safeguard that money. It's where the account, whenever a case settles, that the money that is paid from the insurance company or individual from the defendant is put into that client trust account. And that is also where the money is dispersed out to any clients or any lien holders or anything to do with that disbursement. And it's also where we collect our fees and expenses from.
And are there legal obligations and money in the client trust account to ensure that that money only goes to the legitimate places it's supposed to go?
That's correct.
And if the law firm wins a case, whether by settlement or by trial, any recovery they get, does it go in that trust account first before the law firm gets paid?
Everything does, yes.
Now, I'm going to go back to exhibits. The employment agreement, I believe, is Exhibit 310. And right here in line 3 right there, can you read that to the jury, please?
Services for the benefit of employer. All professional services rendered by the employee shall be rendered as an employee of the employer, and all proceeds and remuneration received therefrom shall inure to the employer's benefit.
All right, and this is the agreement signed by all the partners, correct?
Correct.
And back in 2021, it was signed by Alec Murdoch, correct?
Correct.
And all the years prior, correct?
Correct.
And what does that provision mean? Explain that again to the jury.
That means that any work they do providing legal services and any money earned by them belongs to the law firm, not the partner, to the law firm, and should run through the law firm's books
and accounts. It has to go through the law firm's books before it can.
Correct.
And then they have to wait till the end of the year for it to be accounted for after paying all the overhead and the salary and the 7.5 and all the rest of it.
Correct? That's correct.
If a law partner were to divert fees to himself personally and not send them to the law firm, what would that be?
Stealing.
Stealing. Okay. All right. Tell me a little bit, if you would, about the management structure of the law firm. How does it work? Just very quickly.
So each attorney, have equal authority and equal choice. But basically, we'll have a little committee each year that we can go to with day-to-day issues and make some basic decisions that are then gone on and voted by the whole firm. I report directly to each and every attorney. So I would handle day-to-day obligations within certain authorities, and if I had an issue, then I would go to this committee or somebody who is present, because a lot of times attorneys are out of the building, traveling in hard, and it would kind of go up the rank from there.
Okay. Was Alec very involved in the actual management of the firm?
No.
Were other partners more involved in the management of the firm?
Yes.
Tell me, what was your observation of Alec as a lawyer in the office? What was your observations and characterization?
Alec kept different hours than a lot of the rest of us. He came in and he would work late, always loud, always busy, always in a rush. he had the gift of gab, but he always seemed last minute and hurried and frenetic.
Okay. Always last minute and frenetic?
Yes.
What about his cell phone use? How was he with the cell phone?
Constantly on the phone.
Constantly on the phone. What were your observations of him as a lawyer?
I think Alec was successful more off, not from his work ethic, but from his ability to establish relationships and to manipulate people into settlements and clients into liking him. So he did it through the art of bullshit, basically.
That can be an art.
Mm-hmm.
Did he, in your estimation, in your judgment, was he more of a technical type lawyer, or was he one that really understood how to use the emotion of a case?
He would use the emotion of a case and the emotion of his clients.
Did he understand the emotional value that the sympathies of a case could have?
I would.
Your Honor, I'm objecting.
He's asked her to testify as what he understands, what's in his mind. I object.
I sustain the objection.
With Ellis, your observations of Ellis as a lawyer, what skills did you see in how he was able to value a case?
I would think that he was able to read the client. And it seemed to, he always got higher settlements than it looks like they should appear going back when we reviewed everything. So I think that he used his personality more than technical skill. I think that, you know, we look back and we see things that were manipulated and set up, and I believe he did that a lot with his clients as well.
You mentioned, did Al get good results? Did the defendant get good results?
It appeared that they usually did, yes.
Were they very lucrative results?
Yes.
Did you have any observations in working with Alec for 20 some odd years about his memory?
I think that looking back, where I thought he was chaotic and didn't remember things or kind of got bored with details sometimes and wouldn't finish things off, I really think looking back, as we've gone back and pieced together a lot of this, that we saw where he would tell people one thing and another person another. So in my opinion, looking back, I think he had almost a photographic memory, you know, to keep all the balls in the air that we now saw were in the air. It appears that he would have to have a really strong memory.
You had mentioned before that for the firm to operate at the beginning of the year after it cleared its books, that it would loan from or take loans from partners at their option in order to sort of give some seed money until fees started to roll in. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 428 to your testimony and just have you take a look at that and ask if you recognize those documents as it relates to a particular instance involving the defendant.
I do.
All right. And tell me about this instance. What happened here, please?
Okay, so this is in 2017. A check for the payment got mistakenly written to R. Alexander Murdoch instead of his brother, Randolph Murdoch. So the loan payoff was written to Alec.
Let me slow you down. So does his brother work for the law firm?
His brother does work for the law firm.
And what name does he go by?
He goes by Randy Murdoch. His legal name is Randolph Murdoch IV.
Had Randy Murdoch loaned money to the law firm?
He did.
Had Alec Murdoch loaned all?
No.
All right. And so what happened then?
So as we said, we had the clerical error. And a few days later, Alec came to our staff. And it's not quite clear which staff because our records don't show that, but a voided check, he acted as if he'd lost this original check and had another check written. So a replacement check was then written to Alec again, which was a mistake again.
Did that second check get cashed?
The second check got cashed pretty much immediately within a week or two. And then about a year later, the first check got cashed as well. And that's when I caught in the system that he had cashed both checks. And looking back, I realized that the mistake had been made, that somebody had hit, their names are right beside each other in the vendor list, and that they had made a clerical mistake, and that he was paid money that he was not owed.
All right. Ultimately, did he get that money twice that he was not supposed to have received?
He did.
And ultimately, was it because he claimed that he had lost the first check?
Correct.
Ultimately, did he cash both checks?
He did.
And cash the original one a year later, is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Was he confronted about this back at that time when it was detected, I guess, in 2017. Is that right?
He was.
And he was confronted at that time?
He was. Not. I don't remember that he was confronted by me. I know that Danny Henderson spoke with him about it, and Alec just claimed that he made a mistake and thought that he had paid the money, that he had loaned the money that year, and Danny chose to kind of let it go and sweep it under the rug.
Did he pay it back at that point?
He did pay it back.
All right, so that happened, and the explanation was given, and then he was allowed to pay it back. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And everybody moved on, right?
That's correct. I have to point out that it was, these attorneys worked as a brotherhood and were very family, and they were, trusted him and accepted this the explanation.
What was that word you just used? You said it was a brotherhood?
Yes.
And so when the attorneys are dealing with one another, when the attorneys are dealing with you, how are y'all dealing with one another? What's the basis of that?
Trust.
Trust?
Trust.
And so over the years, when Alec Murdoch would tell you to do a transaction or anything like that, what were you relying on?
His word and trust.
Are you generally familiar with what's been known as the boat case?
Yes.
All right. And do you remember that occurring around in February 2019?
I do.
And again, I'm not, without going into the specifics of the boat case, what was your general understanding of the boat case? Well, let me ask you this. Was his son Paul charged with driving the boat in the boat case, to your knowledge?
Yes.
And was Alec Murdoch sued civilly in the boat case because of the death of Mallory Beach?
Yes.
After the boat case, did you notice any changes in Alec's behavior or his demeanor around the office?
I can't say that I really did up until November, December of late 20.
Okay, and what'd you notice then?
Didn't really notice it then, and we can go back and notice it now. That's when he started making some disbursements that he was stealing from that started getting sloppy. So the things that I noticed are more in hindsight.
And I'll put this exhibit up on the screen. Let me get ahead of myself. This is exhibit 428, which I'd offer in evidence.
No additional objection, Joe.
All right.
It's admitted without objection.
428, this is this is the loan check you were talking about. Is that right?
That's right.
This is where Alec erroneously received a check meant for his brother, Randy.
That's right.
And then ultimately managed to get the same amount twice. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. And how much was that check for? I can bring it to you if you need to see it.
Yeah, you're going to have to.
Yeah, I'll bring it to you. Screen over here is bigger than that.
It was for $121,358.63.
$121,000, correct?
That's correct.
When you received the check, did Alex say, no, this isn't mine. This isn't my $121,000 check?
No, he didn't.
Now, you mentioned, you started to talk about some things you noticed in late of 2020, and let's just set the table a little bit more before we do that. You mentioned disbursements. Tell the jury, before we see some paperwork, tell the jury how disbursements go about. Is there certain paperwork that's done, and how do the lawyers interface with the finance stuff for that to be accomplished?
Okay, so a disbursement, after a case is won, or what we call settled, the money comes into the client trust, just like I talked about. A disbursement will recap how much money was won, how much attorney fees, how much expenses were withheld or earned for our firm in that, and then it will list any loans or liens that need to be paid off. And what I mean by that is like medical liens, medical bills, insurance companies getting their money back for items that they paid, and then it will show the balance that goes to the client.
And so then how do they interface with the finance staff? What does the finance staff do as opposed to when the attorneys prepare those disbursement forms?
It comes over to our finance department. We have the supporting documentation with it, and we will process the checks based off the attorney's signature. Those then go back to the attorneys that handled the case or the paralegals that handled the case. They meet with the client and explain the disbursement to them and give them the funds.
Is the finance staff relying on what the lawyers are sending them to determine what checks should be cut?
Yes.
All right.
With support.
With support?
Yes.
Ultimately, are they trusting the attorneys to provide them the correct information?
We are.
All right, so you mentioned that something that happened in late 2020 that was the first things that you started to notice in the wake of the Bowdoin case that was a little different. And tell the jury what you were about to talk about.
As I said, in late 2020, I really didn't notice it at that point. But some of these items that we're going to discuss started happening at that point. My discovery of things started coming to a head in May of 21.
May of 2021?
Yes.
All right. And tell me, what was the first thing that came to your attention?
So one thing that came to attention was a disbursement that the fees were made out and processed to Forge Consulting. And what that meant is that the fees weren't going into our personal account like they should. They weren't going to the firm. Forge Consulting is a true company that you can do structures of attorney fees, but the way that this was done was not correct. To do a correct structure,
let me slow you down so we can unpack this a little bit. All right, let's first talk about what is a structure. What is a structure? What does that mean?
So a structure means that you can set up a fee in the agreement with the insurance company that you can put that money into an annuity that you'll get it out later. You can avoid taxes now and take them out when you're 65 or whatever year you determine. So it's a way that they can defer income for retirement. If they're having a good year, they can do that.
So maybe an explanation would be kind of like the lottery. You can either get your settlement in one lump sum or you can get it paid over time, correct?
Correct.
All right, and so this is what a structure is getting it paid over time.
Correct.
And are there tax benefits associated with doing a structure?
They would avoid taxes at the year that they made the fee, and they would pay the taxes when they got it out, similar to your retirement 401k.
And is it sometimes common for plaintiffs' lawyers who get recoveries for clients, to have their clients get the settlement in a structure as opposed to getting it in all one lump sum so that there's some security over time with that money?
It is definitely a vehicle that can be used by plaintiff's lawyers. We don't do it very often when in our firm, and when it is done, it has to be, every partner needs to know about it and needs to be agreed upon, because obviously that money's not coming into the firm to help with overhead and expenses. So we have to agree on it, and we have to account for it in our allocations at the end of the year to determine bonuses that we're going to pay out.
Sure, but I'm talking about with clients right now. So clients that receive a settlement, they can elect to either get it in one lump sum, or they can get a structured annuity over time where they get it however much a year for the however many years it goes, correct?
Yes, that's true too.
All right. Kind of like the lottery. You can get the whole big thing but with taxes, or you can get a bigger sum over time, correct?
That's correct.
And so some clients might choose to get it over time so that their money is more secure over a longer time, correct?
Correct. And you generally see that when it's a minor involved or somebody with special needs that has a disability of some sort.
And so what is Forge Consulting, the legitimate business Forge Consulting, what do?
They set up structured annuities for clients like we're talking about. They do special needs trusts for people who are injured or are going to need life care plans, and they handle that kind of. They have a few other things that they do, but I'm not familiar as much with those services.
Have they provided services over the years, the legitimate company Forge Consulting, legitimate services to the law firm and its clients over the years in helping them set up structured settlements?
We do. We've used them 250 to 300 times.
And is there, who's kind of like the main guy at Forge Consulting, the legitimate business?
Michael Gunn.
All right. Now, you mentioned that we're not talking now about the client structuring their settlements, but what if a lawyer wins a big case and wants to, so he's going to get a huge fee. Let me ask you this first. Generally, what is the legal fees for the firm when they win a case, whether by settlement or by trial?
Generally, they're 33% to 40%, and it depends on what stage the case was in or the work we had to do. So if we settle a case before we have to start doing summons and complaints and depositions or going to trial, we take 33 1/3%. If it goes further, we do 40%, and it can go to 45% if it's on an appeal. But generally speaking, it's between 1/3 and 40%.
So let's say that somebody's a partner, and let's say they win a case of $10 million, and it was a 40% one, so they're gonna get a $4 million fee, correct?
Correct.
All right, let's say that they decided that instead of taking that fee, that $4 million fee, they want to structure that fee just like a client would. Can they do that?
They can do that, and that's what I was referring to before. With the authorization of the other partners and making sure that we have enough money to operate and enough money to account for it, if they do that, it's supposed to be done in the release, and the insurance company will send the money directly to Forge Consulting and not through us.
Okay. Because it can't go through y'all directly, or it doesn't work.
Or he would not get the tax benefit of it.
And if a, if an attorney still had to do that, they're going to have to work everything out with y'all to make sure everything's accounted for the end of the year bonuses and everything else.
That's correct.
Okay. Is that a common thing that people in the firm were doing?
No.
All right. So, kind of setting all that up, did you, what came to your attention as it related to the defendant, Alec Murdoch?
So in May 17, there was a disbursement called Hirschberger that the fees were said, I'd have to look at the exact disbursement, but it said structured fees, Forge, and it had an amount.
Let me get something marked real quick.
Yep.
All right, I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 429 to your testimony, and have you just flip through that real quick and tell me generally what that is.
Okay, this is the disbursements to do with the money recovered in the Hirschberger case, and this one had multiple disbursements.
All right, but let's just talk about the one you were just referring to.
Okay.
I'll show it to you.
It's this page.
On the third page of this exhibit, is that right?
That's right.
All right, pick up your story. What did you notice that came to your attention?
So it says PMPD attorney fee, and in parentheses it had Forge. The check had been made out payable to Forge, and I knew this was incorrect, so I went and had a discussion with Alec about this. And the basics of the discussion was we needed to know about if they were going to do a structured annuity, we needed to do it. Also told him that the way he had done it was incorrect, that he would not be saving any tax consequences, that he needed to properly set it up with the insurance company on the front side.
Right. And why wasn't it done right? Why were you telling, at least from what you knew at the time, why did you think it was not being done right?
Basically because it should have gone from the insurance company directly to Forge. We would not write a check and send it to Forge for a structured fee.
Let me put this up on the screen just real quick.
You know, no other objection to 429.
All right, this time I move states 429 into evidence, I believe, without additional objection. All right, so is this the disbursement sheet you were talking about?
Yes, sir.
And this is generally the first one the jury's seen, but is this generally how disbursement sheets look that are prepared by the law firm?
Yes, you generally see the caption and then our inside number, which is the matter ID. You'll see the recovery and who's paid out then the next section should be your fee and expenses.
All right, so you've got the fee right there, correct?
That's correct.
And then you have expenses, and what are generally, what are expenses?
So the expenses are the case costs that we paid going along, cost to get depositions and pay transcribers, medical records, expert opinions. Sometimes vehicles are involved that we store. So it's anything that we pay on behalf of that case.
All right. And so they'll have to come out of the recovery too, correct?
That's correct.
And that's separate from the attorney's fees, right?
Correct.
All right. So the, when y'all settle a case, you're going to get your attorney's fees, but you're also going to get paid back any costs and expenses you had to litigate the case.
That's correct.
Two separate amounts.
Correct.
All right, and then we've got a lien. Explain to me what a lien is and how those affect disbursements.
So a lien is, it could be as simple as paying a doctor's bill that was guaranteed, or it can be paying back subrogation, which means, subrogation just means if you had insurance that covered it personally, your Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we recovered money, Blue Cross Blue Shield, or Medicare and Medicaid, if you had that, would then be seeking their money back. So that would be a lien.
Sometimes if somebody who got injured, like in a car wreck or something, might have medical bills, and there's a lien for that?
Yes.
And sometimes funds might be withheld to satisfy those medical bills?
That's correct, too.
Is it common for the law firm to then negotiate with the medical provider, like a hospital or whatever, and see if he can get that medical bill down to a number they'll settle for?
That is correct.
And then if you save any money between what their bill was and what you get them to accept, is that additional money that should go back to the client?
That's right.
And are those very common in these types of cases?
Yes, and generally we will not hold up dispersing the money to the client, waiting on that to happen, because it can take a while. So we may have a disbursement that leaves some money in our account, the balance of those bills, while we're negotiating them, and then we'll do a second disbursement to pay those clients that money or the provider the money.
All right. So you pay them the big amount first, and then if you're lucky enough to settle for a lesser amount, then the, whatever's left over, you'll send to them later.
Correct.
All right. So then down here we have then the ultimate disbursement to the beneficiaries, the clients. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right.
And if there's multiple as this one, you would see the split between the two.
And just real quick, whose signature is that right there?
That is Alex.
And have you worked with him for how long, or did work with him for?
22 years.
All right. And so you got very familiar with his signature?
Yes.
You recognize that as his signature?
Yes.
All right. Going back here to this disbursement, we had BNP attorney's fee forge, and then you had that amount. And then what is this next page of this exhibit?
That's the canceled check payable to Forge for $83,333.33.
All right. And you recognize that signature on there?
That's Alex.
Okay. And so when we last left off, you were telling Alex that it had been done wrong because it had gone straight from the trust account direct to what you believe to be Forge at the time, correct?
Correct.
And it can't go to the law firm or the tax benefits go away.
That's right.
All right. So you raised those issues with Alec. What was his response when you first talked to him about this?
His response was that he was not worried so much about the tax ramifications and saving the taxes, but that he was trying to get money in Maggie's name due to the boat accident that had happened in February of 2019.
All right. Go ahead.
He also brought up the fact that he was friends with Michael Gunn and that was going to try to work with Michael Gunn, putting up some fees during the year as a favor to Michael Gunn and to help him accomplish putting money in Maggie's name.
Did he say anything, and I apologize if you already said this, did he say anything in response to your pointing out that this isn't going to work for the tax benefit?
He said that's fine. He was not worried about the tax benefit so much as getting the money in Maggie's name.
Because of what?
The boat wreck.
Because of the boat wreck. All right. Did that concern you at all?
Yes, it did.
And why did it concern you?
Because that is hiding assets, and we're not going to be part of any hiding assets or any wrongdoing. So we're very concerned that he was trying to do that, and we didn't want to be a part of it.
At that point in time, did you do anything about it, or did you kind of table the matter for the time being?
We kind of tabled the matter for the time being. I had it kind of set aside, trying to figure out how am I going to account for this in my books, and we were going to go back and talk to partners and kind of figure out what we were going to do.
Ultimately, when is the sort of the drop-dead deadline that you have to account for everything in the books?
Usually, I will do our final closing and balance all the time, but usually we'll do that final accounting in December. So I really start drilling down and looking at everything and balancing out in December. But I knew I had till December to figure this out. And at that point, I was more concerned about how we were going to put it on our books and also letting the partners know what was going on so we could make sure that it was disclosed to his attorneys with the boat wreck stuff.
Just kind of just put that aside, but keep it in the back of your mind?
Right.
This was in May of what year did this happen?
21.
All right. Later on that month, did you receive a communication of any sort from Alex Paralegal?
I did on Monday.
Who was that, real quick?
That is Annette Griswell.
All right.
And she's one of his paralegals.
And what did what communication did she have with you?
So I received an email. I was working in our Waldorf office that day, and I have received an email from Annette that said she needed to talk to me in private, and could I please meet with her when I got back in the office. So when I did get back in the office, we met, and she came to me with another concern that in another file that we had.
And tell me what file was that?
So this file was, we refer to it as the Ferris file. And it was a case with Ferris versus Mack Truck that had a fairly significant settlement. And the concern was that we had only received the expenses. This case was handled by Chris Wilson's firm, and they were handling the disbursement. All the money went through their account, and they drafted the disbursement and met with the client. So if that happens, typically the associate attorney will mail us our fee check and our expense check at the same time.
Let me slow you down. So this particular case, the Ferris case, was Alec Murdoch the only attorney on that case?
In our firm, I believe he was, but Chris Wilson was the associated attorney.
Is Chris Wilson in PMPED or is he in a different firm?
No, he's in his own different firm.
And does that happen sometimes that two lawyers, one lawyer from your firm and one lawyer from another firm, will share a case?
Yes, we have quite a lot of that.
All right. And then ultimately those fees have to be split whichever way they agreed to do that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then sometimes if the settlement money or the trial money comes into that other firm, then they have to disperse the fees and expenses to you.
That's correct.
And tell the jury again, what was Annette's concern? Did she receive part of it but not the other thing?
Annette received only a check for the expenses.
But not the fees?
Not the fee, which is unusual.
All right.
So she had already, unbeknownst to me, contacted my staff to make sure that we had not received that fee prior. And indeed we checked and it had not been. So the conversation Annette had with me that day was her concern that we were missing the fee check. And she'd had some conversations with Vicki Lyman, who is Chris Wilson's paralegal. And that led Annette to believe that Alec had already had the money paid to him.
And that's the concern that she reported to you?
Yes.
All right, hold on for me and I'm gonna show you what's been marked as States 312. Give me one second. Your Honor, I believe States 312 is offered for admission with no additional objection.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Submit it.
All right, I'm going to show you this packet of documents. I'm going to go to some emails that are within it. And first of all, I'm going to show you this one right here and just see if you recognize that, please.
I do.
All right, tell me what that is.
This is an email from Vicki Lyman, who's the paralegal for Chris Wilson, to Annette Griswold, who's the paralegal for Alec Murdoch. And in it, Annette's questioning, why did we get the expenses and no fee? Vicki replied back, dear friend, it's only cost because your boss and mine got their fees once they were signed.
All right, so that's why Annette brought that concern to you.
Right? Yes.
All right. Did you have any conversation with Annette about what to do?
Well, Annette expressed concern about tattling on Alec and perhaps getting in trouble for him or retaliation from him. So I told her.
What's the concern? What's the concern right now?
The concern is.
I just asked her what her concern was.
The concern was that that money had been stolen.
There's an objection. Wait. Yes, sir.
He's asking her what Annette's concern was, and Annette needs to testify about her own concern.
All right, sir. State the question, please.
I'll restate the question. What was your concern?
My concern was that he had stolen the fees and they were paid to him personally.
All right. Did you, in this conversation with Annette, did you instruct her to do anything? Did you send any email?
I sent an email to Annette asking for Annette to get copies of the complete disbursement from Chris Wilson's office, along with a copy of what we call the general ledger printout, which would show the deposit and the checks, and the supporting document to the disbursement. Oftentimes, we'll just get a copy of the disbursement. So I asked for the full records like we would have in our office.
And what did you tell Annette to do once you sent that email to her?
Annette forwarded that email to Vicki Lyman at Chris Wilson's office.
All right, and I'm going to show you what's been was part of Exhibit 312, and it's marked as 2374 at the bottom. And just kind of read that email going up. Is that the email that you sent to Annette?
Yes.
And is that the one that you were asking her to forward on?
Yes.
To request additional information from Chris Wilson's office to try to get to the bottom of it?
Yes.
All right. And if we go to the prior page, is that where Annette forwarded that document on to Vicki Lyman at Chris Wilson's office?
This is.
All right, and just real quick, what was the date on that email when it was ultimately forwarded to Vicki Lyman at Chris Wilson's office?
That email was sent on May 27th, but Vicki was out of the office on vacation, so Vicki replied to Annette on June 2nd upon her return.
Okay, and what was the reply?
And the reply was just clarifying what documents that they needed. And at that point, Vicki replies back to Annette that she's not privy to that information, but she'll forward it on to Chris Wilson.
To her boss, Chris Wilson.
Yes.
All right, so have y'all gotten an answer at this point?
No.
All right, so what's the next step? What happens after that?
So we're waiting for a while, and on Monday, May 7th, I went to Alec's office searching for him after lunch.
Real quick. After you sent this email on June 2nd, did Alec ever reach out to you or talk to you about the inquiries that you were making about where these fees were?
Yes, he actually came in the next day. First thing, Chris did not answer me, but Alec came in the first thing and said, that money's in Chris's trust. Why do you need all this information? And I basically said, we just need it for our records. It's what we have in ours, and it's required for us to keep. He assured me that the money was over there and that he'd get the records and they'd get everything that we needed.
And that was some point after June 2nd?
I believe it was the next morning.
All right. And did you seek him out, or did he seek you out to say, hey, no, that money's there the whole time?
He seeked me out.
All right. And that's what he told you?
Yes.
All right. Around this time, did anybody else, did you have any discussions with any of the other partners about what was going on with this?
I did. I'd initially gone to Lee Cope because he's one of the partners that does a lot of the managing, and he happened to be the one that was in the office when this was going on that I could find and talk to. And he also helped me come up with the plan of how we were going to handle it so Alec would not think Annette was questioning. Mark Ball also knew some about it, so.
Right. Was there any discussion about anyone contacting Chris Wilson?
After we didn't get it, that came later.
That came later?
That came later.
Okay. All right. So Alec comes to you and says all that money's there. What's the next thing that happened that you did?
So the next thing that happened was on Monday, on June 7th, I went looking for Alec.
Let me slow you down. On Monday, June 7th?
Yes.
What year?
21.
June 7th, 2021. What happened?
went to look for Alec, and when I got upstairs, he was standing outside of his office leaning on a file cabinet, and he looked at me with a pretty dirty look, one I'd not seen before, and said, "What do you need now?" Clearly disgusted with me, which kind of raised my hackles, so I said, "Well, let's go in your office and talk about it." When we went in his office, I told him, "I have reason to believe that you received the fair's money directly to you, and you need to prove to me that you did not." And he assured me again that the money was in there. I told him I still needed to see the ledgers or proof that it was. Again, he told me the money was in there, that we could get it any time, said he was trying to leave it in there to decide what to do as far as structuring some more money or putting more money in Maggie's name.
You asked him for proof, is that correct?
Yes.
Proof that he didn't have that money?
Yes.
Were you able to complete that conversation on the morning of June 7th, 2021?
It was actually the afternoon of June 7th.
Afternoon.
But no, we were not able to complete it during the middle of our conversation. He took a phone call, and the call was saying that his father was in the hospital and that there was nothing more could be done, and he was terminal. So at that point, you know, I've known Alec since I was 16 years old, known the family forever. It turned into a personal conversation about, "How's your dad doing? How's everything doing? You know, what's going on?" And I basically thought he was leaving to go to the hospital to attend to his father, so I left the office at that time, and we did not discuss the money anymore.
You thought he was leaving to go?
I thought he was going to go to see about his father.
He had gotten a phone call about his father June 7th, 2021, correct?
That's right.
Did you have a conversation with Alec later on that day?
We did. Around 4 o'clock, my phone rang, and I remember because I was surprised that he was still there. And Alec was asking me some information about his 401k balance.
And why was he doing that?
He was doing that because he stated he had to get some documents and financials together for a hearing regarding the boat wreck later that week.
He needed his own financial information for a hearing for the boat case that week, correct?
That's correct.
Do you know when the boat case was? The boat case hearing was?
I believe it was June 10th.
June 10th?
21. Within a few days.
Within a few days.
Were you surprised to hear from him in the office?
I was, because I thought he was leaving.
Thought he was leaving because of the call from his father.
His father.
Did you go home at the end of work that day?
I did.
Went back home and had a normal evening?
Yes, until about 10:30.
Tell me what happened at 10:30.
I got a call or started getting texts from friends asking if I'd heard if Maggie and Paul had been shot. I didn't know anything about it. They were hearing things on scanners. So I've sent texts to a couple of the attorneys and did not hear back until probably 2 o'clock in the night. Mark emailed me back or texted me back that they in fact had been shot and killed.
Was that shocking?
It was very shocking.
Was everybody scared?
Very scary. You know, nobody knew what was going on, so very scary.
You said this law firm is like a brotherhood, correct?
That's correct.
Did everyone rally to Alec's aid?
We did. Nothing happened that week at work. Everybody spent time with Alec trying to support him, bringing family meals, attending the funerals, so nothing happened all week.
After the murders happened, was anybody at all concerned about getting the proof for those missing fees after those murders happened at that point in time?
We weren't, because we were concerned about Alec. He wasn't working a whole lot. He was erratic. We knew he was taking pills. We were just worried about his sanity, so we weren't going to go in there and harass him about money when we were worried about his mental state and the fact that this his family had been killed. It just wasn't even on our mind at that point.
Wouldn't be on your mind, would it?
No.
As a few weeks went on, did you ever receive any communication about those fees that kind of put the matter to bed at least a little bit?
We did. Lee Cope, who is one of the partners, took over. We decided we were not going to press Alec. But Lee made some contact with Chris Wilson during that time, asking Chris for information. And I believe after that, Alec searched me out again and said, hey, I've got that money. But it wasn't until, I believe it was July 19th, I received an email that Chris had forwarded to Alec. Alec then forwarded the email to myself and Lee Cope. And in that email, it said, I am holding the fees for the Ferris case, and he named the amounts and said they are available anytime that you should need them. So we're being told by outside counsel that the money is there.
Did you trust what you were being told?
Yes.
When you got that email, did at least for the time being, that looked like the matter was put to bed?
Yes. I mean, these are members of the bar who've taken a sworn oath that we're supposed to trust, and they're telling us the money's there.
I'm still in Exhibit 312, and we'll put this up on the screen. Do you recognize that?
That is the email that I'm referring to.
And this email comes from who to who?
Comes from Chris Wilson to Alec Murdoch.
And then it gets sent to who?
Myself and Lee Cope.
From who?
From Alec Murdoch.
And can you read to the jury that paragraph right there, what was forwarded to you to sort of put this matter to bed?
Alex, as discussed, I am confirming that I'm holding in trust $600,000 in the Andrell Ferris case and $192,000 in the Denise Ferris case, which represent attorney fees. I will continue to hold these monies in trust until I'm instructed by you and your firm regarding payment.
Does that leave you to believe that those monies have been there all along?
Yes, with some hesitation on my part, because it still seemed a little shaky to me. But I've decided that I would have to believe what was presented to me.
And this, what's the date on this particular email?
July 19th.
So we're just
over 2021.
Just over a month after the murders, is that correct?
Yes, a little over.
I'm going to take you forward a little bit. Well, let me ask you this. In that time period in July and August, going into early September, is Alec in the office much?
He's not in the office very much, no.
You had mentioned before the first thing that kind of came to your attention, and what case was that?
Hirschberger and Ferris.
All right. At some point in time, does that Hirschberger matter kind of come back to your attention to take a look at that?
Yes, like I said, I had it sitting there on my desktop right in front of me, but due to work and personal obligations and things that were happening that summer, I didn't start looking again until September. And I decided to start combing through his fees for the year and just making sure that we had not missed anything else.
Before you go on with that, around that same time as you're doing that, does Annette Griswold come into your office?
She did. Incidentally, during the day, after I'd found what I'm about to discuss with you, she walks into the office and had found a check on Alec's desk that was made payable to Richard Alexander Murdoch, and it was from Chris Wilson's trust account, and the amount, I believe, was $225,000, and it was signed out on the memo, Ferris fees.
All right. I'm going to show you what's been marked as States 313. See if you recognize that.
That's the check I'm just discussing.
All right. Your Honor, this time I would move States 313 into evidence.
No additional objection.
Admit it.
And what is States 313?
That is a check from Chris Wilson's client trust account payable to Richard Alexander Murdoch Esquire in the amount of $225,000 referencing Ferris fees.
Is it made out to the law firm?
No.
Who's it made out to?
It's made out to him personally, Richard Alexander Murdoch.
When you see this check, what, if anything, is your realization?
That he stole the money, that he'd been lying.
And what's the date on that check?
March 10th, 2021.
All right, so when that brings you that check, and you're also looking at the forward, you said, explain what you were doing as well when this is going on.
So simultaneously that day, I decided to print out a listing of Forge payments to Forge Consulting. And as I was printing those out, I was printing supporting documents and canceled checks. And as the canceled checks hit the back of my printer, I could see Alec Murdoch's signature on the back. It would say Alec Murdoch, and a lot of them were Bank of America. And as everyone came out, I started noticing it more and more, and the sickest feeling you could feel in the world, I knew that he was stealing all this money. At that point, William Barnes just happened to call over to my office and said, "What are you doing? How are you doing today?" And I said, "I'm about to throw up. You need to come over here," and showed him the checks, at which point he verified that he thought that was Alec's signature as well. From there, we called Mark Ball. Mark Ball came and looked over the information. We showed him the proof of the check of the $225,000, and Mark noticed that one of the cases that he definitely knew it could not have been going to Forge because it was a workers' comp case.
Which case was that?
That was Thomas Moore.
Okay, keep going.
So he knew that that money couldn't have been sent no matter what. We also discussed this with Lee Cope. We were trying to decide, how are we going to handle this? What are we going to do? Lee Cope, it was decided that Lee Cope would contact Michael Gunn directly. And we named a few of the cases. We got a few of the names. Lee contacted Michael Gunn, asked him if there'd ever been, to please verify if there'd ever been any structures with that, and also asked Michael Gunn if they'd been banking at Bank of America. Michael's reply to Lee was that they had not banked at Bank of America in a number of years, and that he was unable to verify that those were indeed set structured fees for those clients.
All right, so let me slow you down real quick. You researched what name in there?
Forge Consulting.
So you're researching in your system Forge Consulting, correct?
Yes.
To see any instances where it was an Alec Murdoch case that went to Forge Consulting, correct?
Correct.
And did you find a number of checks?
We did.
You have access to the firm trust account checks on your system?
Yes.
And when you saw those checks, what did you observe that caused that sickening feeling you just described?
They were made to Forge instead of Forge Consulting, but also the fact that his signature was on the back and the endorsement on the back was Bank of America.
And what did that indicate to you about all those checks when you saw his signature on them?
That they were stolen fees, stolen money.
That's different from this, correct?
That's correct.
What's being stolen? What, if anything, is being stolen with Exhibit 313?
The check is being written directly to Richard Alexander Murdoch. And in the other scheme, it is written to a Forge account. which we realized was a bank forged bank account. We found in the office a few days later bank statements that said Richard Alexander Murdoch doing business as Forge.
All right, so you say a few days later in Alex's office you found some bank statements?
That's correct.
Do you remember what bank they were on?
Bank of America.
And I'm going to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 335 and see if you recognize that just as an example.
I do.
And what is that?
This is a bank statement from Bank of America with the name Richard A. Murdoch, sole prop, which means proprietor, doing business as Forge, and it has Alex's home address as the contact on the bank account.
And you found bank statements on this account in his office, correct?
That's right.
Is this the legitimate Forge bank account?
It's the fake Forge bank account.
Your Honor, we don't have any additional objections.
I would offer a 335, Your Honor, at this time. Is that the name that was on the account that you found?
Yes.
Okay. And you called it, quote, fake Forge.
Fake Forge.
And why do you call it fake Forge?
Because there is a real Forge Consulting, but this was a fake company that he set up to mimic and look like and designed to look like Forge.
The real Forge, who's the main guy at the real Forge?
Michael Gunn.
And does this account right here in Alec Murdoch's name have anything to do with the real Forge?
Absolutely none.
Going back to Exhibit 313, this check, the problem is who should have this check been made out to?
That should have been made out to Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Elsdroth, and Dietrich.
To the law firm, correct?
That's right.
All right, so who is not getting what they're supposed to get in this instance for this check?
The law firm.
When we start talking about the fake Forge account, who's generally not getting what they're supposed to get? Is the law firm or someone else?
Generally the client, sometimes the law firm, but generally the client.
Generally clients. All right. Show you what's been marked as States 314. See if you recognize this.
Yes, this is a spreadsheet of all the payments made to the fake Forge, referencing each client and the amount that was stolen from each client.
And did you prepare that?
I did.
All right. And is this based on an investigation that you had to do in the wake of all of this?
Yes, we did. We also had forensic auditors come in and look at this. We hired former FBI to come in and look at this, and we've also self-reported to the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, which maintains licenses, and we've turned over 10 years of information to them at least and provided them with all this.
Let me see it real quick. Your Honor, at this time we move into evidence States 314.
Your Honor, we do not have any additional objections, provided we understand that it's being offered for the limited purpose for which Your Honor instructed the jury yesterday. It's not character evidence, it's only the motive, according to the state's theory.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. All right. We're going to pick up on your story in a little bit, but you were saying that when Annette Griswold around the time she brought you that Chris Wilson check that had Alex's number name on it, you also were bringing up and searching Forge in your system, and that's when you saw all these, quote, fake Forge checks, correct?
That's correct.
And you mentioned that you went and talked to some partners about it and that sort of thing, correct?
That's correct.
Right, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but just real quick, as we go to Exhibit 314, this is that spreadsheet that you prepared, is that correct?
That's correct.
And we have the, what's this right here?
That is the date of the check where the funds were stolen from.
All right, and then right here?
That's the client name.
All right, and then right here?
That's what we call the civil action number if it's been filed within the court.
All right, and then the category?
Is what type that he did. Most of them are forged payments, or you see a couple other, took insurance, so it's, he had a few methods.
All right, and then over here, is that when y'all had to pay the money back?
Yes, so for each one of these, the money that was stolen, all the partners got together and had to put the money back into client trust, and we went through and corrected and met with every client and distributed money back to them. That's an ongoing basis still going on.
So for all these clients, you had to pay, the law firm had to pay money back?
The partners came up with money and paid all the clients back.
And why did y'all have to pay all that money back?
Because Alec had stolen it.
We're going to talk about these in a minute, but if we look at the bottom, at least for this category, what was the total that you have, at least for this category?
$2,841,512.55.
And at least in this category, the earliest date we have is roughly what year?
2015.
Right, let's go back to early September. Do you remember what day it was that all this was happening?
September 2nd.
All right, and that brings you this check. You're finding these things. You say you talked to some of the partners about this?
Correct.
And what happens after that? What do y'all do?
We had a partner meeting at Lee Cope's house the morning of Friday, September 3rd.
Is the defendant there?
No.
All right. Is Randy Murdoch there?
Randy is not there initially. Initially, we showed all the remaining partners what we had found and that that he had been stealing. The consensus was, let's get Randy in here and let's show him so he wasn't blindsided. Randy came in, we presented him the evidence, and he immediately hung his head and said, he stole it, we've got to do something about this.
All right. And did anybody then go make contact with the defendant?
So Danny Henderson and Randy Murdoch went to confront Alec about it.
And what was reported to you after that conversation?
The report was that Alec had admitted that he stole the money and that we were forcing him to resign.
In the wake of all of that, you ultimately had to start doing this review, is that correct?
Yes.
And this spreadsheet that we're about to go through reflects those various transactions, is that correct?
That's right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break now. If you'll go to the jury room, please do not discuss the case.
That concludes segment number one of coverage in the trial of Alec Murdaugh, day number 10. There's much more to come. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and continued coverage here on The Case. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.